It's about 2 o'clock, and this is Barbara Ridenour with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated December 2nd, 2016. We'll start today's readings on the front page with It's Their Turn, Aging Inner City Parks to Get Upgrades. Decatur. In a city with 30 neighborhood parks and 11 community parks / nature areas, taking up a combined 1,400 acres, older parks needing a facelift must wait their turn. Every year, the Decatur Park District chooses a couple of parks that need the most care. We try to fix up, clean up, remove some old, and make some additions, said Rodney Burr, Park District Chief Financial Officer. Garfield and Torrance are the primary focus this year. Ryan Raleigh, Director of Operations, said neither park has gotten much use recently, especially after improvements in the installation of new basketball courts at Hess and Mueller Parks. People see them, Garfield and Torrance, and they're run down, Raleigh said. A lot of times it's taking old things out to help make the park look more open, clean, and inviting, and putting something new in. We try to provide amenities that will be used heavily, and we try to spread out the improvements and balance them to benefit everyone throughout the community, he added. And as we've seen at Hess and Mueller, the improvements have caused people to move to those. With improvements at Garfield and Torrance, we hope to see people gravitate back there. Garfield and Torrance will get upgrades to their pavilions, Raleigh said. There will be general cleaning, painting as needed, and restrooms will be renovated. We'll make the improvements to meet the ADA, American with Disabilities Act, requirements for the restrooms, making sure that there's a grab bar and everything is at the right height, Raleigh said. The old stalls are block partitions, and they're too narrow for wheelchair accessibility. So we'll tear those out and make them into single-user restrooms with a lock on the door. We'll also replace the lighting with LED lights. And at Torrance, one of the faucets has rot and needs to be replaced. Torrance, 655 East Grand Avenue, is the fourth oldest park in Decatur and was the first in which the city acquired the land specifically for use as a park. The land was purchased in 1910, and by 1912, trees had been planted and it had a pavilion, playground equipment, and a wading pool. The park, which has 19 acres, has been upgraded several times through the years. This upgrade will remove the two older basketball courts that are tucked away in the south side of the park and put a new one near the pavilion. Also, the concession stand near the baseball diamond at Torrance will be removed. A number of years ago, we went away from the neighborhood baseball diamonds to having baseball complexes because it's easier to drag the fields at one location rather than trying to get out to all of them, Raleigh said. We'll leave the ball diamond there so neighborhood kids can use it to play baseball, softball, kickball, and wiffle ball. But we'll only drag it once a week compared to 3 or 4 times a week at the complexes. Also at Torrance, the small road that comes off the parking lot and connects Grand to Cantrell will be closed. A lot of people drive through there, and we'd like to eliminate that to cut back on the amount of pavement we have to maintain, Raleigh said. The total estimated cost for the project, minus the ADA requirement construction, painting, lights, and cleanup, which come out of different funds, is $70,000, $45,000 for the basketball court removal and installation, $5,000 to remove the concession stand, and $20,000 to repair and remove the access road. Garfield Park, 1055 West Grand Avenue, was created in 1938 when what was known as the Becker Tract was acquired by the Park Board. Dunham Street, which used to run all the way north to Grand, was closed at Leafland Avenue, and the area was combined with the Garfield School Playground to form Northwest Park. A shelter and playground were added in 1939 as part of a Works Progress Administration project, and it was renamed Garfield Park in 1945. Garfield will also get a new basketball court, with the older ones being removed. Raleigh said ideally the new court would be put on top of the old tennis courts at Garfield, but the park district staff is still trying to determine the best course. Where the tennis courts are would be the best spot because it moves it away from the residential area and closer to the road, Raleigh said. We still need to look at it and see what the base is under the tennis courts. If they're asphalt on top of asphalt, we won't have to do base work and it will be a lot more affordable. But if it's over concrete, where if the concrete cracks, the asphalt's going to crack. It's going to be more difficult. Another improvement at Garfield would be the addition of a half-mile crushed limestone walking trail. Both parks will receive sidewalk improvements, though Garfield's are in worse shape and will be more extensive. Garfield's facelift is expected to come in at around $120,000, $60,000 for the basketball court removal and installation, $30,000 for the walking trail, and $30,000 for the sidewalks and pavilion improvements. Construction on the new projects are expected to begin, weather permitting, when the funds come available March 1st. In government and politics, General Assembly okays Exelon Bill. Springfield. The holidays will be much happier for families of 1,500 workers at Exelon Corporation's Clinton and Quad Cities nuclear power plants. The Illinois General Assembly voted Thursday to approve an energy policy overhaul that will keep the plants open for another decade. It was the final day of the fall veto session. The House voted 63-38, and the Senate voted 32-18 in favor of a massive package that will funnel $235 million in annual ratepayer subsidies to the unprofitable nuclear power plants and increase investments in renewable power and energy efficiency. Governor Bruce Rauner said he will sign the bill when it reaches his desk. For jobs, for ratepayers, and for the state of Illinois, this is a good bill, said State Senator Neil Anderson, Republican of Rock Island, said when the bill came to the upper chamber Thursday evening. Exelon had said it would take official steps toward shutting down the Clinton plant June 1st if lawmakers didn't approve the bill during the veto session. The Quad Cities plant was set to close a year later. The two plants together employ about 1,500 full-time workers and generate millions of dollars in property tax revenue for schools and local governments in their areas. State Representative, Bill Mitchell, Republican of Forsyth, who represents the Clinton plant, said a closure would have been devastating for his district. People really thought in DeWitt County that it was going to close, Mitchell said, and they thought that it was their fate, so this is a good Christmas for them. After the proposal passed out of a House committee Wednesday with apparent agreement from the Rauner administration, it appeared headed for passage. But lawmakers were kept waiting for several hours Thursday as amendments were drafted to address last-minute concerns from the administration. Among other changes, one amendment removed language that would have guaranteed union-level wages for workers on projects funded through the legislation, and another delayed the effective date to June 1st to lower the vote total needed to pass the bill. Bills passed in the veto session that take effect immediately need three-fifths majorities in both chambers. State Senator Chapin Rose, Republican of Mahomet, who also represents the Clinton plant and sponsored the legislation in the Senate, said passage appeared uncertain for much of the day. Rose credited Rauner for getting involved in negotiations over the past 2 weeks, which he said ended up producing a stronger bill. After the administration weighed in, Exelon dropped a controversial proposal to change the way customers are charged for their power. The so-called demand charge, based on a monthly average of peak demand rather than overall consumption, drew widespread criticism from consumer groups and the Illinois Attorney General's office. Critics said it would have created unpredictable bill spikes. The biggest brick on this bill was that demand charge because There was no defense to it, frankly, Rose said, adding that it wouldn't have come out without Rauner's involvement. Excuse me. He and Anderson also credited the administration for pushing for rate caps to limit the cost for customers. Officials with Exelon's subsidiary, Commonwealth Edison, estimate that the entire package will result in an average monthly bill increase of less than 25 cents for residential customers in northern Illinois over a 13-year period. The bill caps the increase at that level. Ameren Illinois, meanwhile, estimates that its downstate residential customers will see a 12-cent increase on average. The average increase over the 13-year period is capped at 35 cents for Ameren customers. In the end, the measure passed with bipartisan support. State Representative Mike Smitty, Democrat of Hillsdale, said it will provide an economic boost to his district and the state. Smitty, who lost a re-election bid last month, added that it was meaningful to see the bill passed before he departs. Going out on this legislation is something I can hang my hat on, he said. However, the bill also faced strong opposition from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, many of whom viewed it as a bailout for a profitable corporation. The bill faced intense opposition from some business groups, including the Illinois Manufacturers Association and other large energy users. State Senator Kyle McCarter, Republican of Lebanon, said it was an example of the state picking winners and losers. McCarter said large energy users, such as Decatur's Archer Daniels Midland Company and Tate & Lyle, will see energy prices rise as a result. Other downstate lawmakers also objected to coal power plants and Illinois coal mines being left out of the bill. An earlier version included subsidiaries for Dynegy-owned coal plants in southern Illinois, but those were dropped to maintain the support of environmental groups that backed the bill's provisions on renewable power and energy efficiency. The Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition, made up of environmental and consumer groups, praised the bill's passage. This bill includes elements of difficult compromise, but ultimately this is a tremendous victory for Illinois, the coalition said in a prepared statement. We commend members of the General Assembly from both sides of the aisle for their passage of the bill, and we urge Governor Rauner to sign it to jumpstart Illinois' clean energy economy. Herald and Review names Coates its new editor. Chris Coates, the new editor of the Herald and Review, is a man with a mission. He said the vital role of the newspaper is to inform its readers and to stand up for them at the same time, to be their voice and eternally vigilant watchdog guarding their welfare, watching out for the interest in the government space, in the regulatory space, making sure people are not abused financially, that sort of thing, said Coates, 34. It's about being an advocate for the reader, delivering strong public service journalism. Coates, who will start his new job January 3rd, comes to the Herald and Review with a solid track record. For more than 18 months, he served as watchdog content coach at the News Journal in Wilmington, Delaware, overseeing investigative reporting, political and government coverage statewide. Before that, from 2011 to 2015, he worked with the Sioux City Journal in Iowa, which is owned by Lee Enterprises, the corporate parent of the Herald and Review. Coates started as city editor there and rose to be executive editor, managing newspaper and digital content. His efforts were a two-time winner of the National Newspaper Association General Excellence Award. He was born in Trenton, Michigan, close to Detroit, and earned a degree in journalism from Columbia College in Chicago. After college, he started his journalism career as a staff writer with a weekly newspaper in Los Angeles and went on to work for a business publication in California. He was then named managing editor in 2007 of the Suburban Journals of Greater St. Louis, based in Collinsville. Coates has a lot of experience and expertise in managing and developing digital content for newspapers and said this is a big frontier facing print journalism. I think it comes back to some of the basics of strong journalism, he said, of the digital realm. Being connected with the community, being aggressive but fair, but with watchdog reporting, and being smart about how we use our resources. Digital is a huge part of it. It's our future. Coates said that wherever readers get their news, print, online, on their phones, what matters is the quality of the product that competes for their attention. Busy raising two daughters, Carly 4 and Caden 2, with his teacher wife, Lisa, Coates wants his children to grow up in a world with journalism they can rely on and trust. I think the word paper might not be around when they get to my age, he said with a laugh, but I believe the product will still be there, and that is really important. The medium doesn't matter, really. It's about journalism. I want my children to have a strong community news organization that delivers smart analytical coverage, and my daughters will be consumers of that coverage if I have any say in that area. The hiring of Coates is seen as a key step in building the future of the Herald and Review, according to Julie Bechtel, the newspaper's publisher. The hiring of a new editor for the Herald and Review wasn't a task I took lightly. The editor sets the tone for the newspaper and the way it interacts with the community, Bechtel said. After years of solid newsroom leadership that appreciated what makes the community great, it was important to find someone who could build upon those established relationships and help the Herald and Review meet the new challenges. I believe Chris is that person. Coates replaces Gary Sawyer, who retired after 15 years as editor and general manager of the Herald and Review. Coates said he believes good journalism is always worth the extra effort because it makes life better, and a good newspaper is still the most effective way to deliver that journalism. The mark of a strong community is a strong newspaper, he said. On the local page in government and politics, more security upgrades planned for jail. Decatur. The Macon County Jail is set to get another technology upgrade, this time with the brains of its security operation, a system. With Thursday's approval by the Decatur Public Building Commission, the next upgrade for the jail will include the door controls and programming of the security system. Essentially, it would assist officers in how they monitor the goings-on within the jail. When an officer pushes a button to open the door, the system would pull up cameras around the door and allows streaming from the cameras straight to the officer's monitors. It will improve the quality of how they review what's going on throughout the jail, Commission Manager Jerry Lord said. The system would also be integrated with previously purchased digital cameras and digital recording systems. The switch from analog would help reduce the wiring necessary with the older technology. The whole package is the most expensive part of the jail upgrades, and the board unanimously approved a bid from Indianapolis-based Security Automation Systems to cover the work at $193,800. Aside from being the low bid, the commission is already working with Security Automation Systems to repair the current system. With approval, Lord said that it should be about 6 months before the upgrade is finally implemented. The latest upgrade is among those that have been approved in recent months to bring the jail to more modern standards, including the purchase and installment of new cameras and video recorders. Earlier this fall, the commission approved a plan to allow correctional officers on their mandatory cell checks to digitally mark what cells they have inspected and the exact time that it was done. It's Christmas time in the Schaub Center. This is recreation. Decatur, there's always debate about when it's the proper time to start decorating for Christmas and listening to Christmas music. But that argument doesn't exist at Schaub Floral Display Center, 3415 East Lost Bridge Road. The Monday after Thanksgiving, Decatur Park District Horticulture Superintendent Josh McGrath and his two staff members had Christmas music filling the Schaub Center as they worked on the annual holiday showcase, which begins today and runs through January 6th. The music puts us in the mood, McGrath said. From 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. daily, except for Christmas and New Year's Day, Schaub's free exhibit will picture 6 different varieties of poinsettias, with about 150 total on display, and 15 different varieties of amaryllis situated around the center's large 16-foot evergreen Christmas tree in the middle. In addition to the display, the Horticulture Department will also hold a plant sale from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. today and Saturday. The plant sale includes poinsettias, large plants for $7, and a few smaller ones also are available, as well as many rosemary trees, $12, and succulents, prices vary. Succulents are cacti and other plants with fleshy leaves. The money raised from the sale benefits the Park District's Horticulture Department, which plants and maintains flower beds in parks across Decatur. A look into the Schaub greenhouse gives a glimpse of the variety of plants and flowers the Park District utilizes. Many of the plants were donations, and McGrath said he has no idea how many different species are in the greenhouse. We start all of our annuals and perennials in here, and we have a pretty good collection of cacti, succulents, and a pretty good orchid collection we include in the display too, McGrath said. We have everything in here, from tropical water plants that we put in the Oriental Garden, banana trees, elephant ears, a coconut tree. Exactly how many? It's a lot. It's something I wonder about sometimes. We need to do an inventory sometime and see. Right now, the workers at Schaub, in addition to setting up the holiday display, are starting the flowers that will be planted in the spring. They began growing the poinsettias that are being displayed now back in August. The poinsettias are pretty easy, McGrath said. Everyone talks about the day length and darkness, but most of these new varieties naturally color on their own. Basically, we fertilize them, feed them, keep them watered, and grow them up until they're big and pretty. In addition to the traditional red-leafed poinsettias, there are red and white and pink-leafed varieties. Then there are the highly popular jingle bells, which are red spattered with white. It's a genetic variation, McGrath said, and also ones with leaves that look like they're pink with white frosting called, well, that depends. Some people call them Da Vinci's, some people call them Monet's, and I've also heard them called ice crystals, McGrath said. Red is always popular, but the more unusual ones are getting more and more popular. Once the holiday showcase is over, it's on to getting ready for spring. People think you get 2 or 3 months vacation, but it's always full in here, McGrath said. As soon as these go out, we start washing everything out and propagating for spring. If you go, it's the Decatur Park District's Holiday Showcase and Plant Sale. The showcase is every day from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. between today and January 6th, except for December 25th and January 1st. The sale is from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. today and Saturday. It's at the Schaub Flora Display Center, 3415 East Lost Bridge Road. For more information, call Josh McGrath at 217-421-7550. That's 421-7550. Project Linus volunteers blanketed with thanks. This is Faith and Values. Forsyth, a colorful Illini quilt given to her son during his battle with cancer, continues to give comfort more than 6 years after his death. Your blankets soothe, and they bring solace any time they're used, Shannon McCarter said as she unfolded the quilt for her audience. This is one we pulled right off Adam's bed. The mother of Adam Carter, the popular Holy Family Catholic School sixth grader who died in 2010, was among the speakers who thanked members of the Central Illinois chapter of Project Linus for their continuing mission to make blankets for seriously ill and traumatized children. Carter and Linda Ellison, perinatal bereavement coordinator at Carle Foundation Hospital, helped call attention also to the need for bereavement blankets during the chapter's annual volunteer appreciation breakfast Thursday at the Hickory Point Golf Club banquet facility. During her remarks, Ellison displayed a prayer shawl a friend gave her when her 31-year-old daughter was dying of H1N1 influenza 7 years ago, and said she still wraps it around her when her grief resurfaces. She encouraged her listeners to make blankets, especially the knotted and crocheted variety, for parents who lose an infant and not just the child alone. It's something very soft and cuddly they can wrap their baby in while they're bonding with them and saying goodbye, Allison said. That blanket can go with the baby if the parents wish, but we also try to give the family a blanket, so they have that keepsake too. Mary Blagna, chapter coordinator, said volunteers may label their work as bereavement blankets if that's how they want them to be used. She also reported that the chapter had donated more than 87,000 blankets as of September 30th, as it begins its 19th year of service in January. More than 100 blanketeers attended Thursday's breakfast, but Balagna said that her volunteer roster contains the names of more than 250 people who make the blankets, distributed by 20 medical facilities and child care agencies across central Illinois. New to that list, she said, is the Child First Center in Decatur, formerly known as the Macon County Child Advocacy Center. Other speakers Thursday were nurse manager Mary Beth Miller and nurse Stacy Stickney of the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit of HSHS St. John's Hospital in Springfield. Carter said she too appreciated having a prayer shawl to use while sleeping near her son's hospital bed. Adam was a goofy, sweet, funny, giving, joyful little kid, she said. Both my children were blanket babies. Blankets are such a comfort in the dark of night when you're scared, when you're sad, or when you're feeling alone, she said. Local briefs for Friday, December 2nd. Brooks honored. The practice gymnasium at Eisenhower High School will be named for Ida M. Brooks during a ceremony about 2 p.m. Saturday, December 3rd. The ceremony will follow a girls' basketball game that begins at 12:30 p.m. Brooks, who died in 2015, worked for Decatur Public Schools for 35 years, coaching girls basketball at Eisenhower for 20 years. Terminal Railroad. Dale Jenkins, author of the book The Illinois Terminal Railroad, The Road of Personalized Services, will give a presentation at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday, December 3rd, at the Macon County History Museum. Jenkins will discuss how the interurban railroad was part of Decatur-Macon County life from 1904 to 1955. Admission is $2. For more information, call 217-422-4919. That's 422-4919. Car theft charges in Charleston. Charges have been filed against a Moultrie County man suspected of stealing three vehicles and setting fire to two of them in Coles County last month. Caden R. Deedman is also accused of leading police on a chase that reached speeds of more than 90 miles an hour before he drove another vehicle, reportedly stolen in Moultrie County, into a river. Deedman, 19, of Sullivan, admitted to Mattoon police that he stole two vehicles in Mattoon and one in Charleston, according to court records. Those vehicle thefts took place a few days before his arrest after the crash into the Little Wabash River in southwest Coles County on November 11th. Charges against Deedman in Coles County include possession of a stolen vehicle, arson, and aggravated fleeing or attempting to elude police, all felony offenses. He is in Coles County Jail on $50,000 bond. Correction. The times for the Millikan University Vespers concert were incorrect, and Vespers bring back the holiday spirit in the Thursday, December 1st Herald and Review. The times are 2 and 7:30 p.m. Saturday, December 3rd, and Sunday, December 4th. The newspaper erred. That's all we have time for the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated December 2nd, 2016. This is Barbara Ridenour. Please stay tuned.